From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For more than 60 years, oil and military interests have glued together an uneasy alliance between the United States and Saudi Arabia. Now, the oil-slick ties that bind are loosening as the ruling House of Saud scrambles to combat a domestic impression that it is sleeping with the enemy. Neoconservatives in Washington see a terrorist breeding ground in the old U.S. ally. Tonight, On Point, rethinking Saudi Arabia. First, Colombia's new president, President Alvaro Uribe, has declared a state of emergency and vowed to go after his country's powerful leftist guerrillas. Earlier, I spoke with T. Christian Miller, staff writer for the L.A. Times in Bogota, and asked him if the stage is set for an all-out showdown in Colombia.
Absolutely it is, Tom. The state of emergency hasn't been used in Colombia in the past 7 years, and it's a reflection of just how serious Colombians are taking this conflict. And it's measure for the first time, actually, that the Colombian government is going to use all of the weapons at its disposal to confront the country's various leftist rebel groups, which have been fighting against Colombia for more than 40 years.
This is more or less what the new president promised in his campaign. Now he's delivering.
Absolutely. New Colombian President Alvaro Uribe was elected in May precisely on the promises of cracking down on the rebel insurgency here in Colombia, and he's moved quickly to do just that. He's raised taxes to hire more troops. He's created a citizen militia one day we'll have more than 1 million people in it to act as informants to the government. And he's moving rapidly to consolidate military strongholds to take on the Colombian rebels.
What will the state of emergency mean for Colombians? Will there be civil liberties given up for some duration? How does it work?
We're going to have to wait to see the full effects of this state of emergency declaration. Uribe has 90 days in which he basically can make any law he wants to, which affects the situation of public order in the country. It has been talked about that he may begin allowing wiretaps without any sort of judicial control. He may begin limiting the movement of rural farmers from one town to another or require them to register at police stations. And he has also imposed this new tax, which the richest Colombians, about 400,000 out of a population of 40 million, will have to pay to augment the number of troops in Colombia's outmanned armed forces.
So this is moving well beyond rhetoric. What's the size of the tax, and what has the reaction of people asked to pay it been?
So far, the state of emergency and the tax as well have met with surprising unanimity in Colombia, which, like any society, has lots of different opinions and attitudes amongst its people. But you see everybody here from the far left to the far right completely joining in and saying, you know, enough is enough. We have got to stop these rebels. We've got to do something about this. And you're seeing very little protest to either the threat of restrictions on civil liberties or the possibility of more and higher taxes. The taxes might be easily by the fact they will be only applied against the richest Colombians, although the total amount raised will be almost close to U.S. $1 billion.
Which is a lot in Colombian terms.
Oh, that's a huge amount of Colombian terms. It will allow the Colombians to employ up to 40,000 new armed troops, which will almost increase by 25% the size of the Colombian armed forces, which is now about 150,000. You'll see them at about 200,000 troops by the end of next year.
And will that be paired with more aid and manpower from the U.S.?
That's a really interesting question, Tom. The U.S. has said they're willing to step in and back Colombia, but first, the Colombians have to take the war effort on themselves. And one of the traditional complaints in Congress has been that Colombians don't do enough. They don't pay enough for the war, and they're expecting the United States to pay for the war. With these new moves, I think Uribe is positioning himself politically and militarily to take advantage of future offers of U.S. aid. There's no threat yet or no sign that anybody is willing to send U.S. troops to Colombia, but I think what you'll see in the future is a lot more money going to pay for a lot more military hardware here in Colombia.
Colombia was under an official state of siege for almost 40 years until 1991. How long is this state of emergency expected to last?
The statutes that created the state of siege earlier in the century here in Colombia have been replaced by a new statute, which is what Uribe used now. That statute specifically limits the amount of time that you can have a state of emergency precisely because of the abuse of the old statute, which resulted in accusations of torture against Colombian rebels and things like that. This new state of emergency can only last a maximum of 270 days, after which point in time it's unclear if Uribe will have the power to declare a second state of emergency, or what exactly would happen, since it's a new phenomenon.
T. Miller, is this a fight that the government, even with itself all braced up and flush with new tax money and new troops, is it a fight that the Colombian government can win?
There's no way, Tom, the Colombian government can win this fight, and you won't find any disagreement about that, even amongst the top ranks of the Colombian military. Everyone knows you're not going to be able to defeat a rebel army spread out across the entire country, which is the size of Texas, Oklahoma, Louisiana, Arkansas combined. So the goal is essentially to pressure the guerrillas, to bully them back into negotiations in which they're in a weaker position. So the Colombian government can reinitiate peace talks with the Colombians, but with the upper hand, and they can gain some concessions they weren't able to gain in the peace talks which collapsed this February.
T. Christian Miller is a staff writer for the L.A. Times. He spoke to us from Bogota. We're talking tonight about two allies who could not be less alike. One, the United States, trumpets the values of democracy and inalienable freedoms of speech and religion. The other, Saudi Arabia, is ruled by a family monarchy which upholds conservative religious power and beheads criminals. Last week, the Bush administration quickly backpedaled from raw talk by an analyst to Pentagon advisors who called the Saudis America's most dangerous opponents. As plans for an invasion of Iraq roll on, the administration is reportedly looking to new Middle Eastern partners for bases and troop staging. An old alliance is under fire from neoconservatives who talk of reshaping the Middle East. Is it time for the United States and Saudi Arabia to part ways? Is it even possible? And what would follow? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now is Simon Henderson, a writer, consultant, and adjunct scholar with the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He wrote Friend or Foe, an essay that appeared yesterday in the Wall Street Journal. Good evening and welcome, Simon Henderson.
Good evening.
Thanks for being with us. Also with us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
Simon Henderson, you have written that Saudi Arabia appears to be heading in the direction of fundamentalist Iran. That hardly sounds like a great U.S. ally. What's going on here?
Yes, and I should explain to your readers, of course, that it would be fundamentalist Iran, but not a Republican Arabia. The House of Saud, the ruling royal family, want to stay in control, but they've been embarrassed by their friendship with the United States, and the which they've had to balance alongside the conservatism of their population, and have decided that the safe thing to do to protect themselves from being undermined by friends and allies of Osama bin Laden, al-Qaeda, is to tack towards the conservative elements. And in this respect, it seems likely to me that Saudi Arabia will be less of an ally in future and will be more like Iran is towards the United States, which is neutral at best and, frankly, probably hostile.
But Simon Henderson, what's new in this? The House of Saud has for a long time tacked between Washington and conservative fundamentalist Islamists inside its own country and its own power base. What makes this particularly disturbing to you now?
Well, it's disturbing to me now because we appear to be in a logjam. It's when we need the Saudis most, and tackling the situation in Iraq and the potential threat of Saddam Hussein. The United States needs bases in Saudi Arabia. It doesn't appear that it's going to be able to use what facilities it has there in any action against Iraq. And in the slightly longer term, we still need Saudi Arabia as being what it has been in the past and what it sold itself as being in the past, as a reliable source of reasonably priced oil for the United States in particular and the world in general.
And if it turns out that Saudi Arabia has somehow drifted, or that the United States has also moved away, that it can no longer be seen as a friend but is actually a foe, what does that mean? Is it possible to envision a Middle East and U.S. oil supplies and position there without Saudi Arabia as an ally?
I agree. These things are difficult to imagine. But in fact, as I said in my article in the Wall Street Journal yesterday, some of this has effectively taken place already. And for the last few years, from about 1995 onwards, the Saudis were essentially paying protection money to Osama bin Laden, al-Qaeda, so that Osama bin Laden didn't cause explosions in Saudi Arabia and instead directed his energies at American targets elsewhere. So we saw the attacks on the U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania, the attack on the destroyer USS Cole in Aden Harbor, and then, of course, the events of 9/11.
And now we see Washington torn over which way to go, a neoconservative flank apparently ready to kind of rip up the old deal with Saudi Arabia. We all read about the briefing to the Defense Policy Board, this Pentagon advisory panel, that heard from an analyst at the RAND Corporation that the U.S. should demand that Saudi Arabia stop supporting terrorism or face seizure of its oil fields and its financial assets invested in the United States. He called Saudi Arabia the kernel of evil and the most serious opponent of the U.S. in the Middle East. The Bush administration distanced itself very quickly from that, but this is in Richard Perle's ideological hothouse, and it's a hothouse that has got a fair amount of sway in Washington. How much momentum do you think an anti-Saudi movement has in Washington today?
Well, I think it has quite considerable momentum, but then, of course, the Saudis still have friends in the United States and in Washington, and you can make a slight reverse argument to it as well. I occupy what I'd like to consider the middle ground on this, although it often seems to me that it's a very underpopulated piece of territory, a very lonely position to take.
If you're the middle ground and you're asking if the Saudis are even a friend of the U.S. at all, that doesn't suggest – the State Department says relations are excellent. It doesn't suggest relations are excellent.
No. Well, you have to remember the State Department's prime function is to maintain good relations or working relations with as many countries as it can in the world. And if it requires it to gloss over difficulties, then it will. And it's been consistent in this, but frankly, you know, unbelievable. I've spoken to lots of people in Washington over the course of the last 9 months. I've been in and out of Washington several times. I've been speaking again to people in Washington this week. I do, in fact, of course, live in London most of the time. And it's quite clear to me that people in the know here, people who are part of the relationship with Saudi Arabia, consider part of at least great chunks of what the Saudis have been doing as to be unhelpful.
What about on the Saudi side? What's the situation in the royal family there? The king is ill, reportedly in Geneva, and not doing well. Crown Prince Abdullah is 79 years old. How solid a front are the Saudis presenting, even in public relation terms, as being supportive of the old alliance with the U.S.?
Well, the Saudis are very good at putting together a front. And sometimes it's not clear what the front is, but it is a front, and so they interpret it as being still supportive of the United States. Although it is rather extraordinary front at the moment. We've got, as you said, the king is ill. He's in Geneva, resting essentially, or at least having medical treatment there. He was born in 1921. He's 81 years old. The de facto ruler is Crown Prince Abdullah, who's 79 years old, and the next in line after him is another half-brother called Prince Sultan, who's 78 years old. So it's a very aged leadership. An essential part of the way they've operated is to give the appearance of being united, but frankly, it's become more and more of an appearance. There are other indications that there are schisms in the royal family, differences of approach of doing things. I'm not anticipating any sort of palace revolution or anything like that, but I hear frequently accounts that there are differences. The easiest way of telling that there are differences is that they're no decisions are being made because there's no sort of agreement at the very top on what those decisions should be.
But the wheels of history are turning and turning heavily right now. If war in Iraq breaks out, we're going to see a lot of things called to account. We're rethinking Saudi Arabia tonight. There's a big push in Washington to look again at this old ally. What do you think? In a briefing for the Defense Policy Board, the briefer said Saudi Arabia is the Middle East's kernel of evil. Do you agree? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're rethinking the U.S. relationship with Saudi Arabia tonight, or reflecting the debate that's going on in Washington about rethinking that relationship. 15 of the 19 terrorists involved in the September 11th attacks were Saudi passport holders, and a lot has come down the pike since then that has cooled off a relationship based on oil and many decades at this point. What do you think? Is it time to walk away from Saudi Arabia? Can the U.S. afford to walk away? Can you imagine a Republic of Arabia as opposed to the Kingdom, to the House of Saud? Would that be better for the region? Would it be better for the world? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight by Simon Henderson. He's an adjunct scholar with the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and a consultant with SaudiStrategies.com. And by our own news analyst, Jack Beatty. Jack, you can feel the tension in the air as the U.S. girds, it looks like, for war with Iraq across the border. Saudi Arabia was a hugely important staging ground for the last clash with Iraq in the Gulf War. But things are coming to an ugly head here.
Yeah, but I wonder if Mr. Henderson hasn't got things wrong way forward. I mean, what is the dynamic? He posits a result that the Saudi regime, Saudi Arabia, will become more like Iran, a fundamentalist regime, fundamentally in all but name opposed to the United States. But what's going to bring that about? I mean, Dick Cheney went to the Middle East in the spring, and he was told by the Saudis and the Jordanians and others, look, if you invade Iraq, you're going to speed up the process. You're going to help destabilize possibly our regimes and bring new regimes, at the worst, that will be fundamentalist. So, in other words, it's our action in another reading that's driving them toward that result. I don't for a minute blink all the problems with the Saudi relationship. We have talked about them, and they're clear. But, you know, there are other signs. For example, the peace plan for the Middle East. This was a remarkable opening. Steve Van Ever, the Middle East scholar on our program, said this was historic because it said the Arab governments were ready to make peace with Israel. Admittedly, their demands are perhaps more than any Israeli government can meet, but that was something on the table. Now, that was a very important move. Also, one reads that the Saudi government, with the Egyptians, is working on a governmental structure for the Palestinian organization that would essentially boot Yasser Arafat upstairs. And we have supposedly been working in parallel with them. We're going to do what we can with the Israelis, and they are, from what I've been reading, doing what they can with the Palestinians to bring about that reform structure that we want to see. So before 9/11, Mr. Rumsfeld said the docket is clean before 9/11. We want everybody to begin anew now. And I'm not so sure that the Saudis haven't been acting in our direction. And I do think that Mr. Henderson may have his dynamics wrong, that it may be our actions that could push them in that direction rather than any inherent evolution in the regime.
Simon Henderson, how about it? Could it be that Washington's aggressive position toward Iraq is the more important underlying factor in perhaps producing what you describe as an Islamist Saudi Arabia?
Well, several points were raised, but let's just confine ourselves to that point. And it is, of course, an interesting situation. But what I can't understand is Iraq is – Saddam Hussein is a threat to his own country and he's a threat to his neighbors. And yet somehow it's good for the people of Iraq if we leave Saddam there. And Saudi Arabia is happy that the people of Iraq have to live – under the regime of Saddam Hussein, who's not only a threat to them, but a threat to the region. I mean, can we actually accept this and go along with this?
But isn't the prospect of Saddam being brought down and replaced with some kind of democratic government perhaps even more unsettling to the House of Saud?
Well, that part might be unsettling to the House of Saud. I'm not suggesting that it necessarily will be a democratic government in a new Iraq, but what I think the Americans will say to any new leadership in Iraq is that there is one way forward for you, and that is the way forward that you will get supported by the United States. The United States is in favor of an independent Iraq, one which is ruled by Iraqis, mm-hmm. but one which is not a threat to its neighbors, and one which does not rule by fear against its own population.
And yet there's talk in Washington of restructuring, reshaping the entire kind of political profile of the Middle East. Simon Henderson, stand by. I want to bring into our conversation Gary Sick. He's director of the Middle East Institute at Columbia University. Good evening and welcome, Gary Sick.
Good evening.
Thanks for being with us. Gary Sick, help us think about this. What's going on here? Is this some kind of huge shadow play? Is all this talk some kind of effort to pressure the Saudis to fall in line behind Washington's march toward Baghdad? Or is there some kind of real fundamental falling out that's working its way through here?
Well, the falling out took place on September 11th. And the fact that so many Saudis were involved in this and the fact that Osama bin Laden is a Saudi obviously raises concerns and has raised concerns and I think legitimate concerns. But there has been now, especially after the U.S. military operation in Afghanistan, which was remarkably successful in bringing down the Taliban and scattering al-Qaeda, even though it hasn't ended the problem, has created an atmosphere in Washington in which there are a number of people who are basically saying, if we did it to Afghanistan, there are lots of other possibilities as well.
Including Saudi Arabia, Egypt?
The next one is Iraq, for sure. Mm-hmm. And then after that, maybe Iran, maybe Saudi Arabia, maybe even Syria, maybe even Egypt. I mean, in the briefing that you mentioned that mm-hmm. was given to the Defense Policy Board in Washington, he ended that by saying that the real prize of this thing is Egypt.
And what do you think he meant by the real prize? And this is Laurent Muravich, if I've got that right, at Rand Corp.
Laurent Muravich, I assume. Mm-hmm.
All right.
I've never met him, and I don't know for sure how to pronounce it.
But what does it mean that Egypt is the real prize?
Well, nobody
in the
really
great
knows.
Game?
Actually, it was amusing because a few days later, a very conservative commentator, Arno de Borsgraaf, who is mm-hmm. no lily-livered liberal, mm-hmm. Came out saying that this whole thing was bats in the belfry, that this whole idea of basically dismembering Saudi Arabia and going after it was just the craziest thing he had absolutely ever heard.
Well, doesn't it sound a bit like delusions of grandeur here? I mean, we don't have the patience to really stick around much in Afghanistan, let alone reshape all the Middle East.
Well, I think there are two problems. First of all, I don't really think that we have the sort of imperial impulse that we are equipped or psychologically or even in terms of our own bureaucratic structure to manage what would be, in effect, a growing empire, to restructure the entire Middle East to our liking. It's not just that we want to get rid of Saddam Hussein. We also want to get rid of Yasser Arafat. And then if we turn to the Saudis, but, you know, if you really look at it, if you look at what is going on in Saudi Arabia, the very real prospect is, and this is something that I think Mr. Henderson doesn't really address, is that with this highly inflammatory and potentially fundamentalist movement going on in Saudi Arabia, that the next government you get in Saudi Arabia is indeed not a republic, but a highly fundamentalist regime of the sort that would make our present relations with Saudi Arabia look absolutely wonderful by comparison.
We're trying to understand the fire that's being played with here. Simon Henderson, do you agree that if we begin treating this regime as a foe, and act on that, its successor could be much less easy to deal with. Hello, Simon Henderson, did we lose you? I think we might have lost Simon Henderson for a moment. We've got a lot of people who want to join this conversation. Let's turn to the phone lines. Marcia's on the line. Welcome, Marcia. You're on the air.
Hello, and welcome back from vacation, and it's
Thank
good
you.
That you're back, because when you're away, the wheels start falling off the wagon.
Oh,
and
come
they
on.
Can't manage the calls.
Oh, okay? Come on. Thank you, Marcia. What's up?
Frequent listener. I really think the last gentleman that just spoke really hit this on the head. It's almost, there's an undercurrent of let's go after the Arabs and topple all of their regimes and flip their culture and make them into democracies. And that's not who we are. And once again, I think when you're having these conversations, I'd like to see a more holistic conversation that looks at what are our values and what are we doing in relationship to our values. And what we're doing right now, even this conversation, is totally out of the relationship of American values. We do not go around toppling regimes and making choices about who's going to lead what countries and try to undo cultures.
Well, Marshall, let me ask you on that point. It might equally be said that the United States does not or should not go around making allies of ruling monarchies that behead opponents.
I'm glad that you said that, and I want to take that on. This is the reason why I was against the original Gulf War. Mm-hmm. Why would we go to war with a country, break down the regime, and then put a monarchy back? We're not a monarchy. We shouldn't be supporting monarchies. We need to get into alignment with our values. And the minute we do that, we'll get rid of Pérez Musharraf, who is a dictator. And if we're going to clean house in that way, then we need to be consistent. And we are not consistent, which is what's putting our relationships in these areas under stress.
Marshall, we've got it, and thank you for your call. Gary Sick, let me put that to you. How do you see U.S. values, if we can use such a vaunted phrase down here in the rich mud of geopolitical maneuvering, but how do you see those values as appropriately being pursued in the Middle East, particularly with Saudi Arabia?
Well, there's no question at all that Saudi Arabia follows a set of values that are really quite different from Americans. They don't believe in elections. They have a ruling family that has, you know, thousands of princes that have special privileges. This is not the American way, as Mr. Henderson said in his article mm-hmm. in the Wall Street Journal. But does that mean that we then need to go in and take over their territory and break it up into provinces, as was suggested, in fact, in the briefing in Washington? And also, actually, Mr. Henderson wrote an article a few weeks before the Wall Street Journal article in the Weekly Standard, mm-hmm. in which he said we ought to be dusting off our contingency plans to secure the Saudi oil fields. I'm really concerned about this, and it's not just Mr. Henderson, and it's not just Richard Pearl. It is, in fact, a full-fledged movement that is coming out of a number of places, not only the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Times, the National Review, commentary.
And at this point, even on Capitol Hill, Senator Carl Levin, Democrat of Michigan, says that the Saudis have not been a consistent ally of the United States. Senator Fred Thompson, Republican, Tennessee, describes the U.S.-Saudi relationship as a marriage of convenience. That sounds like something that can be undone.
Yeah, I just think that we ought to stop and take a deep breath before we go on in this process. The fact that we responded to Afghanistan, we should have responded. We responded militarily, and we should have. But that doesn't mean that that solution is going to work everywhere and at all times. And I really do worry that the United States is putting itself in the position of asserting itself in ways that we're not going to be able to follow through.
Jack Beatty, I want to come to you on a follow-up to Marsha's values question as well, because I don't see an easy answer here. She suggests it's not the American way to go in and topple governments. On the other hand, the government that we've embraced for a long time, as Gary Sick and everyone else points out, is hardly American in its values. Where's the values path lead here?
Well, it seems to me that we are not an imperial power, and we have lived by a policy called containment that was pretty much the most successful policy we've followed toward regimes that had fundamental antagonism with us. We didn't try to change their social system. We didn't try to topple them. We deterred them. We found ways to live with people, the Chinese, for example, who have nothing in their regimes in common with us.
But Islamist terrorism has now reached out and knocked down the World Trade Center, Jack. Does that change things?
Well, I think it changed them this far. I do think that there is something in the social system of Saudi Arabia and Egypt that helped to produce this. And of course, our bases, you could say, are the immediate cause. That was one of the things in bin Laden's fatwa. But something in those social systems is inimical to our interests. Now, the question is, what do you do? Do you topple the regime, or do you say to these people, look, maybe you ought to soft pedal the Wahhabism. Maybe you ought to rein in the mosque. In Egypt, maybe you say to Mubarak, that fellow you just put in jail, you know, that's just the sort of person we don't want to be in jail because we want to legitimate a democratic opposition. It'll be good for you. It'll be good for us. That's the way you proceed.
Mind-boggling to be going after the Saudis and saying nothing when the Egyptians put a Democrat in prison. Tom is on the line. Welcome, Tom. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm fascinated by this kind of rhetoric coming from the neoconservatives. Mm-hmm. I think they're using this leak as a way to put pressure on the Saudis to allow them to, at least in a minimal way, give military support to an Iraqi invasion. And I think, you know, the lesson here is a lesson that we should have learned from Vietnam. We have the domino theory against communism back then, and mm-hmm. We killed 5 million Vietnamese and we lost a lot of American lives, and frankly, we learned that communism failed from within and doesn't fail from without. And I think the lesson here with Saddam Hussein is a little bit like the lesson with Cuba. When you have an external power constantly demonizing this dictator or whatever you want to call him, they stay on and on and on. I think if we sort of ignored Saddam Hussein for the last 10 to 15 years, he may very well have been toppled. And these neoconservatives who are out to kind of settle old scores because they feel that Saddam Hussein has been a kind of a spur in their geopolitical theme for the Middle East, are out to topple him, and I think it's very dangerous, and I think it's going to unleash a Pandora's box, which will, murder, lots of people, and I think it's kind of short-sighted, and it illustrates, the danger that we have in Washington right now, and I frankly think, most members of Congress are fearful to kind of, step out of the box on this
one. Stand up to it.
I think it reminds me a little bit of McCarthyism in the 50s.
Well,
that's what led to, that domino theory.
You could read that spin on it. Tom, I want to get a response before the break, but thank you for your call. Simon Henderson, I think you're back. And good to have you back. Our callers are suggesting, let's just stay out of this. Let's get a hold of ourselves, calm down here, and back off a little bit. Can the U.S. do that?
If it was any other country in the world, I would say yes, it could. But we're in a curious position. The United States is the most powerful country in the world, both militarily and economically. And like it or not, that gives the United States responsibilities in the world. And those responsibilities are either to wait until something disastrous happens and then be obliged to take the leadership role to act, or to act preemptively, to ensure that the worst-case scenario doesn't take place first. And I suppose, one can argue endlessly about whether Iraq is a worst-case scenario, but I would argue it is a perfect example of a situation whereby a country, or the most important and powerful country in the world, has a responsibility to act.
To the point where you're writing, America, prepare to go in and secure oil fields if things get too far out of hand.
Well, I don't want to become a part of the whole conspiracy theory, which is the antithesis of what I've been saying. But I would
Simon, hold that thought if you would. We've got to take another break. Listeners, is it time to walk away from Saudi Arabia? Can the U.S. afford to even think of it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are rethinking Saudi Arabia tonight, or more to the point, looking at Washington's big rethink of U.S.-Saudi relations. What do you think? Is Washington suffering delusions of grandeur when neoconservatives talk about restructuring the Middle East? Should the U.S. stick with Saudi Arabia? Should it move away? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight by Gary Sick. He's director of the Middle East Institute at Columbia University, and Simon Henderson, an adjunct scholar at the Near East Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Simon Henderson, I had to interrupt you just before the break, but you were looking at this issue of whether or not the U.S. ought to, must, or must not intervene.
Yes, I was trying to make the point that people are saying, The U.S. should move against Iraq now, because that way we can get hold of Iraqi oil or access to Iraqi oil, and this means we won't be so dependent on Saudi Arabian oil in future.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is a secondary concern. I think it's a useful concern. It's a useful additional argument. I don't consider it the principal argument.
I want to welcome into our conversation now Ramesh Ratnasar. He's a writer for the Time magazine, covers the Middle East. Good evening and welcome, Ramesh Ratnasar.
Good to be here.
Thanks for being with us. Help us understand the Saudi view of all this conversation that's going on in Washington. The Saudi foreign minister stood up last week and said, that things are fine. We've always had ups and downs, but everything's fine. But we read that Saudi analysts are very understandably looking at this anti-Saudi rhetoric and seeing a kind of pressure game underway to force changes in Saudi policy, perhaps toward Israel, perhaps on the front of war with Iraq. What's the interpretation in Riyadh?
Well, I mean, my sense is that the Saudis are a little bit concerned, and they realize that the sort of free pass that they've long enjoyed from the United States may not be coming to an end, and certainly being called into question. I think the Saudis realize that they have a serious problem in terms of their image with the American public, and they realize that we now have an administration, or at least elements within the administration, who probably share that view, which is essentially a fairly negative view of Saudi Arabia and whether we would regard that country as a reliable partner and certainly an ally in this war on terrorism. So I think the Saudis are worried. I think they're trying hard. They're starting to flood talk shows and airwaves. They're certainly allowing more journalists into Saudi Arabia to try to get their point of view across. And I think what they're trying to say is, we have been a partner, we have been an ally, we have been reliable, we do share interests. Don't throw us overboard. On the other hand, they do have a public that doesn't necessarily support a close relationship with the United States, certainly doesn't support America's policy in the Middle East, and has absolutely no interest, from what I could tell, in the American effort to remove Saddam Hussein. So I think that's the Saudi problem, is that they're balancing the fact that they do need the United States, and I think value the U.S. Alliance for its own security, but they have a public that is increasingly turning against the United States and against the policies that we're pursuing in the Middle East.
Do you see an Iran-style outcome here where the ruling monarch is tossed out by the public beneath? Is this a tenable balance for the Saudi royal family?
Well, I think what most Saudis would say is that even if there is a certain amount of dissatisfaction, certainly an element of suspicion and kind of latent hostility against the U.S. and against the West, and even some frustration with the royal family that's fairly widely shared among the sort of mainstream in Saudi Arabia. It's a fundamentally conservative society, and that the amount of revolutionary ferment is not really evident in the streets or even in the mosques. The Saudis have done a pretty effective job of essentially buying off opposition. So there is no real political movement that you could see toppling the Saudi royal family at this point.
Even if the United States put on enormous pressure and got them back as a base to attack Iraq and got concessions on Israel and the Palestinians?
I don't necessarily see that would lead to a public revolt or a popular revolt against the Saudi government. If we removed Saddam, in some ways it might make the Saudis' life easier. I mean, there would no longer be a need for American troops in Saudi Arabia. Potentially, American troops would be over the horizon. That would remove a sticking point and basically a source of anxiety for the royal family. So, I don't necessarily believe that we should calibrate our policies based on what we might see as instability inside Saudi Arabia. In the eventuality that we remove Saddam or alter our policies and toward Israel and the Palestinians.
Ramesh Ratnasar, a staff writer for Time magazine covering the Middle East. Thanks very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
We have a lot of people who want to join this conversation. Let's turn to the phones. Imran is on the line. Welcome, Imran. You're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi.
Nice to hear your voice again, Tom.
Thanks.
I just wanted to say that I wanted to pick up on the point that was made earlier about what's in our interest. And, you know, I would say that when we ask that question, our interests keep changing. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, let's not forget that, you know, under the Carter and Reagan administration, the Saudis helped fund, the so-called jihad against the Soviets, working with the CIA when it came to Afghanistan. And, you know, our interest back then was to fight Soviet domination. And so we don't think about what the long-term ramifications are when we decide to make these moves. And so as we kind of talk about regime change, what will be the long-term effect? The last time we actively participated, and that was with Iran and removal of the Shah Mossadegh in favor of the
mm-hmm.
other Shah.
Shah. Mm-hmm.
And this guy was one of the worst perpetrators of human rights violations there was, and he was trained by the CIA.
But what if the new U.S. priority number one is fighting terror, and it emerges that somehow Saudi Arabia's, even at arm's length, kind of a sponsor?
Well, I think, you know, just because, you know, 19 people came out of that one country doesn't mean that the entire population is behind it, or that the government, for that matter, is behind it. I mean, there are individuals within Saudi Arabia who have money. They, you know, they have personal wealth. That's the way their country is set up,
mm-hmm.
and they are sponsoring these Wahhabis. But I don't think it's particularly the House of Saud that's directly responsible for this. And I think if you want to try to diffuse Wahhabism in the region, I think the party that's most apt to do it is the Saudi, the Saudi royal family and the infrastructure that's there.
That's an interesting assertion, Imran. Thank you for your call. Gary Sook, let me put that to you. Do you really see the House of Saud as countering the fundamentalist Wahhabi movement or in a codependent relationship there?
Well, it's a really complicated question, but interestingly, you know, as the caller said, the United States and Saudi Arabia worked together hand in glove at the time of the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan and succeeded in putting together a movement that defeated the Soviets there. That we should remind ourselves when we're thinking back about this, that things that we do of major significance have unintended consequences. And one of the results of that Mujahideen victory over the Soviet Union was the creation of Osama bin Laden, the creation of a network of people.
But what's the lesson there?
Who met in Afghanistan,
mm-hmm.
who worked with him, and which ultimately resulted in the Saudis funding fundamentalist movements all over the world.
So what's the lesson you draw from that, Gary Sick, that we cannot turn to a regional ally to fight, in that case, a Cold War battle that turned hot?
No, but I think that at this point, if we forget that history completely
mm-hmm.
and assume that we have a free ride, that we can now, because we are very powerful, we can call the shots, drop regimes left and right, assert ourselves in ways that really are sort of creating a new U.S. imperium in the Middle East,
mm-hmm.
I really think we're asking for huge troubles. And if we forget the fact that these things have consequences, we're really asking for difficulties far down in the future.
But what if the interpretation is that the root of the terror threat goes in part to Saudi Arabia? Do you buy that, first of all? And if there's some truth in that, how do we deal with it?
Well, in that case, I do think the caller was correct, that it's one thing to say that a number of Saudis joined this process.
Mm-hmm.
It's another to say that the government supported it. In fact, the government threw out Osama bin Laden. It took away his passport. It denuded him of Saudi citizenship. It, in fact, according to all reports, made a real effort to work with the United States to get him released from Afghanistan into U.S. custody. So this is fairly our change of attitude
mm-hmm.
has all been very recent. And it's just been in the last few months that mm-hmm. we have suddenly seen this complete shift from seeing the Saudis as a potential ally, not a perfect ally, perhaps,
mm-hmm.
but an ally, to seeing them as an enemy. And I think
mm-hmm.
that it's very difficult to justify that kind of a very sharp twist.
There certainly is a lot of speed, a lot of spin on this ball. Gamal is calling from Gunnenberg, Iowa. Good evening, Gamal. You're on the air.
Good evening. Thank you for taking my call.
Happy to.
I just wanted to comment on, I think his name was Simon, one of the panelists.
Simon Henderson, yes.
About the fact that we are the only superpower and we have a responsibility. I'm not quite sure what responsibility he's referring to. I think the only responsibility that seems to be of concern to anybody in the administration right now is securing oil sources. I don't think any fight against Iraq or Saudi Arabia has anything to do with moral values.
Well, there has been put forward the idea that the fight with Iraq is about taking weapons of mass destruction out of the hands of an avowed enemy of the United States.
I think that's just a smokescreen. I do believe, I have always believed that. Does he pose a threat? I think the biggest threat from Saddam Hussein is against the Iraqi rather than anybody else, which is an equivalent threat of Mubarak against his people, against any dictator against his people. I mean, they are no different. The only difference is they are our SOBs rather than somebody else's.
So, Gamal, are you saying we should just sit back by the oil and stay the heck out of it at all?
I think we should not stay out of it per se, but we should try to really be honest about what we're trying to do. And if we want to make sure the world is peaceful, we shouldn't be fermenting trouble everywhere just because we don't like this guy or that guy. Mm-hmm. We should state our moral paradigm clearly and stick to it instead of switching sides at our convenience because we can't get the oil at the price we want. Mm.
Gamal, thank you for your call. Simon Henderson, how about it? What do you see at bottom in the U.S. relationship with this region? Is it all about oil and the oil price? Is there any political element here? How do you read the bottom line interests of the superpower?
In 30 seconds, I suppose, rather than about 30 minutes.
Yes,
3 hours, which is what the question really deserves.
Too true.
Frankly, as regards the Middle East, we would not be caring about the Middle East so much if it didn't have two-thirds of the world's oil reserves in it and a great chunk, I think it's 45% of the world's gas reserves in it. If it wasn't such a crucial component of the world economy, we wouldn't care so much about the Middle East, which isn't to say that it's the only thing we care about, but it is an important ingredient.
Mm. Simon Henderson, I want to thank you for being with us, and it's been great having you.
Thank you.
Simon Henderson is a writer, consultant, and adjunct scholar with the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Gary Sick, take us, just before we have to let you go as well, to the oil issue here. It's been put forward that if we got a friendly government in Iraq and we boosted Iraqi oil production and we've got Venezuela and Canada and Russia, maybe the dependence on Saudi oil is less. Maybe that's another reason that there's this new willingness to talk in such rash terms about a change of relationship.
That is true. And Iraq has an immense amount of oil, and it could, in fact, be a major rival to Saudi Arabia as far as oil production is concerned. I think we shouldn't be counting our chickens before they're hatched in this case. That if you think that Iraq and Russia are somehow going to replace Saudi Arabia, you better make sure that your chickens have come home before you, in fact, make that judgment that this is no longer an issue. And I think that's where a lot of people are jumping ahead to say, we can do without all of this, and the past relationship is simply irrelevant.
Gary Sick, I'm sure this conversation isn't over, but we thank you for joining us tonight. Thanks so much for coming on.
It's a pleasure.
Gary Sick is director of the Middle East Institute at Columbia University. Jack Beatty, we've come to Saudi Arabia several times on this show. Here we are with the rhetoric heightened again and all kinds of agendas intersecting.
Yeah, we should point out, as I reported on this program on Friday, that the briefer was a former correspondent for a Lyndon LaRouche publication.
This is the RAND briefer to the U.S. Defense Policy
which
Board.
It doesn't speak well for his sanity. And there was an insane aspect of this, to be talking about Egypt as the prize. I mean, if bin Laden could have anything, it seems to me, he would have wholesale Western intervention in the Middle East. That's the match we're playing with, the war of civilizations, and that's what he wants to touch off.
Well, let's hope not. Jack, thanks for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Log on to onpointradio.org and click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded by